Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Wow. Hi, everybody. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 2nd of 1981, and for that period of time, I'm very grateful. And I also want to wish Steve happy birthday. And I think that if you don't have the memory of this night in your etched in your memory, then God help you. And and Byron, congratulations, happy number 9. And I'll talk a little bit more about Byron, so I won't waste any of this meeting doing that. You know, one of the things that's happened since I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on the second day of January 1981 is, you know, it's amazing to me that the power of these 12 steps. It's amazing to me the power of when I surrender to what goes on in these rooms. And I think about tonight, I think about the people that kind of were here that led me through this path. And the man that today is leading me through the path of Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps. See, I'm an alcoholic, and that's the one thing that today is not up for debate. And it's really the one thing that every morning I wake up and I thank God that today I know what's wrong. I can trace back all my difficulties every day to one simple statement. My name's David Brand. I'm an alcoholic. You know, because of that, now, because, you know, alcoholism, which is what I suffer from, isn't a matter of I drank too much. Just because I consume alcohol and drink alcohol and get drunk doesn't make me alcoholic. There's an awful lot of people who drink a lot of alcohol. If you drink enough alcohol, you get drunk. There's no stopping that. Everybody who drinks too much alcohol gets drunk. Some people get drunk, maybe have a car wreck. Some people get drunk, maybe get a DUI. Some people get drunk and fall down. Some people get drunk and knock the wife in the head. Some people get drunk and slap a kid. None of that makes them an alcoholic. Makes them have bad decisions. I think there's an awful lot of people who confuse drinking too much and getting drunk with alcoholism. And that's not what I suffer from. Because the answer to what I just described is stop drinking alcohol. If you don't drink alcohol and you don't get drunk, there's a good chance you probably won't do all those things. But see, I do those things and worse sober. I do some of those things when I'm trying to fight not drinking. I have a reaction to being sober that is terrifying. I don't like being sober. Sobriety is something that I do not know how to handle unaided. I didn't know that when you're a little kid and you're walking around and you just feel weird. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I don't have any doubt that you know, I was an alcoholic. Whether I'm born an alcoholic or not, I don't know. But I know one thing. I was somebody waiting for a drink. And the very first time I took a drink, I had a reaction to alcohol that makes me alcoholic. I have a reaction to alcohol that when I pour it in my system, it doesn't happen to 9 out of the next 10 people in line. Non-alcoholics, they drink alcohol. They may drink a lot of alcohol. They may get drunk. But they wake up the next day and they go, ooh, I was out of control. I'm not going to do that anymore. Or, ooh, I better stop now. I have to drive later. Or, ooh, I'm beginning to feel it. I'm going to put it down. I poured alcohol into my system at the age of 13, and I had like a metamorphosis. Something happened to me when I poured alcohol into my system that I know probably doesn't happen to the normal drinker. I put alcohol into my system, and it was like all the pressure and all the pain of the first 13 years of my life went away. It's just like, boom, You know, I grew up, I was kind of short and dumpy and fat, didn't run very fast, didn't jump very high, gravity challenged, you know, one of those kids that, you know, you get picked last for the game, you know. There were some other fat kids, so maybe I had a chance not being the, you know, the second to last or whatever, you know. But the problem was, is I always felt different, and I didn't understand why until I drank alcohol. When I poured into my system, boom, things happened. Now, I didn't go insane the first time I drank. You know, I did drink a lot. I did throw up. I did pass out. But none of those make me alcoholic. What makes me alcoholic is the perception of how I fit with you changed. All of a sudden, when I drink alcohol, I fit. I fit into a place where I've never fit before. And I started trying, you know, and then I'd not drink. And that uncomfortability, that knowing I'm unfit or no fit, whatever it is, I got that. And it just intensifies. And that very first time I drank put something in my brain that said to me, from that day to the last day of my drinking, if I take a drink of alcohol, it'll get better. Every time. But now, just because I drink alcohol, that doesn't make me alcoholic. I also have an allergy to alcohol. And it just gets getting worse and worse and worse. In fact, our book says that over any considerable period of time, I get worse, never better. My actions start getting worse and worse. My lies have to become a little more, my lies had to become sophisticated. Because, you know, when you're balancing lies between two and three people now, it's not just one person you're lying to. Your lies of this person have to fit in with your lies of that person because that person might talk to this person. So you got to figure out a lie on that person just in case that person meets this person. And then when you start adding twos and threes and fours, you're spending an awful lot of time figuring out what you're going to do and how you're going to say it and when you're going to say it. And when you get caught, I mean, now you got to be on your toes because now you got to manipulate and you got to change. You got to think and and then sooner or later, you just got to say, well, and if they don't like, then you just cast them aside. And that's what I've done my whole life. As soon as somebody stopped wanting to hang around, I just cast them aside. I just say, and I'm gone. Now I go over to these next people. Now they don't know me, but I'm an alcoholic. I start drinking. I do all that stuff over and over and over. You know, the single line today in our book, in the doctor's opinion, to me is really the key to the why our room isn't full, why people that have sat in our room no longer sit in our room, why people continue to go to try to figure it out. In the fourth step, our book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, I straighten out both mentally and physically. I suffer from a spiritual malady. Now, if you would have said to me that's what I have, I would have denied that. But the doctor's opinion says that unless this person, it describes the alcoholic over and over, drink over and over, the sprees, the phenomenon of craving, over and over, over and over, over and over, over and over, we end up making a phone call late at night to maybe a daughter. And said, I just want to say goodbye. The pain of living drunk and the pain of living sober become more than I can bear. And what the doctor's opinion says, that unless this person experiences an entire psychic change, very little hope of his recovery. Now, psychiatrists can't do it. Doctors with pills can't do it. They might slow us down to where, you know, we're not going to get any spiritual experience. We're just not moving fast enough to cause a hell of a lot of trouble. You know, you right before you're about to, you just fall asleep. You know? But that's all they know. They don't know because they don't understand the disease of alcoholism. They think the problem is drinking alcohol. They say, stop drinking alcohol. I can't tell you how many people lined up. Dave, just stop drinking and you'll be all right. If you just stop drinking, you'll be all right. And I knew that they didn't know. I've tried not drinking. Life becomes so unbearable sober, I can't stand it. And now I have to live a lie. I have to live a lie sober, and I have to try to protect myself drunk. And when you get to a place where drinking is no good and sober is no good, that's alcoholism. And many of us go insane or drink ourselves to death or blow our brains into the back of the bathtub because we just don't know any other. We don't know what to do. It's so unbearable, we just don't know what to do. Now, when you're 20 years old and you're at that moment in life, and you're thinking, you know, I'm only 20. It can't be this bad. But that's where I found myself. So this idea of the spiritual, this entire psychic change. You know what, in our history of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is now, you know, just simply 67 years old. And my sponsor, he's a great historian, and his sponsor is a great historian of our program, and not only of our program, but really the cures that have been tried about alcoholism. And they're talking now that they have there's a new piece of literature they found somewhere in the continent of Africa that is the archaeologists with all their scientific abilities have dated that there's now writing with the human race back to 7,000 years ago. So now the human race has been walking around 7,000 years of recorded human history, and we just happen to be in the place of the last 67 where there's a cure for alcoholism. Now, what that book says is that if I don't have an entire psychic change, there's very little hope in my recovery. Most alcoholics never even get a chance at it. Most alcoholics who call the daughter go home and blow their brains out. Most alcoholics don't call the daughter. Most daughters wake up and they find out what's gone on. Most husbands, most wives, most children, most mothers, most parents, most grandparents, alcoholism just consumes those people. So my job up here, that's my introduction to my talk. So, you know, the thing that you know AA is built on is just one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. That's what AA is built on. That's what Bill Wilson did when he went to talk to Dr. Bob, and Bob stopped drinking on June 10th, 1935. It was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, and the power of one alcoholic who's sober with an answer. That's what AA is. One alcoholic who's sober with an answer can look into the eyes of another alcoholic who's not sober and does not have an answer and say, if you want it bad enough, there's a way out. If you don't want it bad enough, we probably can't help you. And that's just the simple, that's the life and death choice that alcoholics make. Most AAs, most people that walk through this door, and we've recognized it in the 7 years of our group, and every other group that's ever been an AA group, most alcoholics come through our door and the price is too high. Because to have sobriety means an entire psychic change. Now, my sponsor made, you know, that's, boy, that's, you know, do I got to call Miss Cleo? What is that? I mean, I don't get it. You know, what we find out is, that's too woo-woo for me. Entire psychic change. We're going to take you in the back. What my sponsor says, if I work these steps and I work them in order, thoroughly and honestly, and I do that with the direction of a sponsor, that the first line of the 12th step is guaranteed, and really all it means is I'm going to go from being a taker, a self-centered, self-serving individual, and I'm going to pass through the invisible line of Alcoholics Anonymous into this side of the room where I become a giver. Now my process that if I'm going to keep the gift is I have to remain one. There's an awful lot of people that pass and they get a little cross and they give a little bit and then the brain kicks back on. Ooh, the stack, it's out there. My stack's waiting. I have to leave. I can't, oh, you want me to go to a meeting? Nope, can't do that. Call the spot? Nope, can't do that, I'm busy. Go to a meeting? Nope, football game. I go back from what I don't understand is that if I haven't had a drink in a while. I haven't had a drink for almost 7,400 days. That's a lot of days not have a drink if you're an alcoholic. Now many of those days I wanted one. Many of those days I've actually obsessed on drinking. Now the time between one and the other is getting farther and farther apart, but now I'm an alcoholic sooner or later. You know what? You pass, but you don't, you just, for whatever reason, you just, the right time, wrong place, whatever. Little flashy lights. I love the flashy lights. You know, little whispers coming from that dark room. Ooh. Ooh. Now, I'm an alcoholic. See, I have an obsessive mind. I have tunnel vision. I don't see over here responsibility, family, job, wife, kids, grandkids. I don't see all that. Twinkly lights, ooh. she might be in there. I don't know who she is. I'm still, ooh. Maybe, you know, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable how my mind does this. And sooner or later, if I don't have the ability to meet a commitment that I've made to a sponsor or to a home group, and I stay on that tunnel vision, I'm out of here. And that's what happens. So why does this psychic change occur? Because I get in line. I say yes to a sponsor. I get to a place where the book talks about I've become hopeless. Our book uses the word hopeless several times. In the 12 and 12, it actually says that in the early days of AA, only the desperate actually made it here because they were really the only ones who could make the admission of hopelessness. And it even went on further to say that even most of these desperate ones couldn't do it. And today, I don't believe that has changed because only the desperate ones really stay. Only the ones that can actually admit hopelessness stay. I don't know why that is. Well, yes, I do. It's alcoholism. So now, my story started, like I said, I took my first drink of alcohol when I'm 13 years old. I didn't know that I'm going to become an alcoholic. I just know that that drink tasted good. Actually, it really didn't taste good, but the effect that it had on me felt good. Now, I'm a guy about feelings. I like good feelings. I'm all about feeling good. So I spent the next 7 years of my life chasing feeling good at the cost of all other things. I grew up, I've got two older brothers, and my father was a professional ball player for the Chicago Cubs minor league system, so sports was a big part of our upbringing, and that's what we did. We competed in sports. My father taught me the fundamentals of sports. I know how to shoot a basketball, I know how to throw a football, I know how to throw a baseball. I'm not too good when you elevate me. If I'm up on skates, that doesn't work very well, so I stay away from that kind of stuff. I picked up golf when I was about 13, and right after about that first drink, and I started becoming very good at golf. By the time I was a senior in high school, I was playing down to a one handicap, and I was competing in some of the tournaments around the Chicago area, and it looked like golf was going to be a deal that might get me somewhere. I was competing against guys at that time that are today out on the professional tour, and at that moment, I was playing as well or better than some of them, but I'm an alcoholic. And sooner or later, in alcoholism, you will begin to choose. You will begin to force to have to choose, you know, because if you're going to do something, you have to commit to it. Now, alcoholics, you know, we feel like, you know, society says, boy, those alcoholics, they're weak. No willpower. I'll tell you what, it takes an awful lot of willpower to hang in there. You know, most of us hang in there. We shoot way past the mark. We hang in there. And we got a lot of willpower when it comes to booze. We don't have a hell of a lot of willpower when it comes to most other things because we're thinking about booze. And so sooner or later, I start giving things up, and that's exactly what's taken place. My freshman year in college, I was on the golf team in a junior college, and we won the Illinois State Junior College Championship, and they flew us off to a tournament in Odessa, Texas. And I stayed sober the first 2 days of the tournament. You could either make the cut. It's a four-day tournament, and after 2 days, half the field's eliminated. You could either make the cut as an individual, you could make the cut as a team. Now, the team didn't make the cut, but I made it as an individual. And on that second night after the tournament, I took a drink. And I almost didn't make the tea time for the next day. I showed up with less than 14 minutes of sleep, so hungover that I'm hitting three balls. And they're all on this. You know, because now I don't feel very good, I drink the third night, and I play worse the last day than I played on the third day. And whatever really opportunity, because there's a lot of scouts, there were some opportunities, there were all those things, and I didn't even know it, because I just took a drink. That second night, my mind just said, just go have a beer. The guys said they're going to have a beer. The guys that didn't make the cut, they don't have anything to play for. So they said, let's go have a beer. That's all it is. They never said to me, Dave, let's go get so intoxicated that you're going to give up your life's dream. Let's go have a beer. See, I'm an alcoholic. I have a phenomenon of craving. I put alcohol in my system. I have a reaction to alcohol normal people don't have. I wish I would have been a guy that said, ooh, I'm feeling it. I'm going to go home now. I got to tee off. I took a drink, and golf never came back into my mind until 5:30 in the morning. And I've got a 7 o'clock tee time, and I'm 27 miles from the golf course. And I'm so drunk I can't see straight. And so one more time, there it goes. And I've made decisions time after time after time like that. Do I want to do those things? I don't. But what I don't understand is the doctor's opinion says that I'm not drinking to escape. I'm drinking to overcome a craving that is beyond my mental control. Now, that doesn't give me an excuse for all the bad actions and all the bad and how I've hurt people. That's not an excuse for any of it. But it explains something that I didn't know. I thought I was weak. So obviously I gave up that. So now the only things left, I'm still, I'm trying to go to college, and I graduated from this junior college, and I go to Northern Illinois University, which is about 40 miles north of Chicago, and tryout for the golf team, didn't make it, and so now I'm just going to class. Now what happened was, is I thought, okay, I love Bill's story where he says he imagined himself at the head of vast enterprise. I love that sentence. The amazing thing about the statement is it starts with, I imagined. See, I've got a great mind. I imagine a lot of stuff. I can sit at home and have full-length movies about Dave. I don't need a television or radio. I can just sit on the couch and think about me. Ooh. Ah. I've done it again. And so I imagine myself at the head of Vast Enterprise, except my grades from the junior college don't qualify me to lead Vast Enterprise. And so they told me what I'm qualified for, and they said, well, you probably qualify to be like a plumber. There's a hell of a lot of very smart plumbers out there, but that was one thing I wasn't really aspiring to be. So I took a few stupid classes, I signed up for stuff, and I proceeded to really start drinking like I wanted to drink. This was the first time in my entire life I was out on my own, and I never had to answer to anybody. And I drank every night as much as I could drink whenever I could drink it. Now, first step says that we become powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Best definition of unmanageability I ever heard was this, is when I drink alcohol, I don't have the ability to complete the day's tasks that I set out to complete. Or that when I drink alcohol, for whatever reason, I can't stop from doing the unspeakable actions that I do, and I never even wanted to, didn't have no intention to hurt the people I did. I don't either do the things I should do, or I do things I know I shouldn't have done. I don't know a better definition of unmanageability than that. And when I drink alcohol, there's three, at this point, there's only three endpoints. I run out, I black out, or I pass out. That's it. When I start to drink, those are the only three things that will occur. I ran out a couple times. I drank. There was one option: stop drinking or drink like a warm Pabst Blue Ribbon beer with sand in it. I love sandy beer. I need a drink. I was at a bar and I was out of money, and obviously I was out of friends because they weren't going to buy me anything. I asked a bartender that he had just wiped up spilled goo on the bar top. I said, would you bring that out in a glass? Maybe I could. Have you ever had like corn chip? I need a drink. I need a drink. That's just what I don't know. I need a drink. Or I've had, one of the things that goes on in the college campus is that, one of the great party times on a college campus is Halloween. So back in 1980, one of the movies that was out was called The Warriors, movie about gangs. And so me and a bunch of goofs that I was hanging out with, we decided we were going to go as the Baseball Furies. It was one of the gangs in the movie The Warriors. And so we dressed up like the Baseball Furies. We got baseball uniforms and painted our face red and white, got baseball bats. And I didn't have a baseball bat. But I had a 4-foot oak pole in my closet. So I grabbed my oak closet pole with my Baseball Furies costume and went to the party. Now, I drank alcohol, and there's only one or three options to take out. And this night, I didn't run out. But this is a night that I black out. And now I'm apt to do whatever things are capable of me doing. And what was told to me is about 3 o'clock in the morning, some people saw me walking across DeKalb in a direction that I was going this way, and I lived over there. So they decided, well, we'll grab them. So they grabbed me and take me back to where the apartment complex that I live in. And I didn't walk into my apartment. I walked into my downstairs neighbor's apartment. They were partiers, so they were still up at 3 in the morning. And what they told me was, is I walked into their apartment, and I had about this much left of my oak pole going, ooh, I was hurting people. And see, I don't remember any of it. And I know I'm capable of acts of violence because I've had several fights, and I mostly lose, but I'm capable of acts of violence, and I know it. And I don't know what occurred that night. So when they told me that the very next morning, what I started doing was I started looking for information. And so, you know, I got the DeKalb newspaper. I got the college campus newspaper, which usually lists all the nefarious crimes that go on a college campus. So I was looking in there for a couple of days about somebody dressed up in a uniform smacking people with a closet pole. And I couldn't find it. So I did with that piece of information what I've done with every bad act I've ever done. I just discard it. And I just push it aside. You people don't matter to me. I don't care. If I hurt you, get out of my way next time. Now, actually, I'm trying to get an education at DeKalb, Illinois, and I haven't attended too many classes because you really shouldn't go in my condition, so I didn't. And our apartment, the apartment I'm living in, we're living, you know, book says we don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic. Doesn't mean we don't. We just don't like to. And these guys were probably alcoholic. I know one thing, our apartment was. The apartment I lived in, every cup, plate, saucer, bowl, piece of silverware wasn't in a cabinet or in a shelf or in a drawer. It was all on the kitchen, on the tops of the counters, or it was submerged in probably 2 to 3 week old mucky water in the sink and just stuff floaties, you know, and you just, every once in a while we'd go, we should clean. And, you know, if you wanted to use a plate, and you're taking your life into your hands. Paper products in our apartment, we had three kinds. And they were all interchangeable. They all could act as any of the others. We had paper towel, we had coffee filters, or we had toilet paper. And at one time, any of them could be any other three. Mr. Coffee became a good friend of mine. The carpet in our living room, because we had a lot of guests. We had guests over. And it had that kind of glistening, kind of alcoholic, sticky, gooey crunch to it. You know, you'd walk out and the footprints would still be in the carpet. I don't know, it was late November, and I came to one morning, and my face was in the carpet. And I had an intuitive thought. I got a test. I didn't know why, but I knew I had a test, so I better go to my class and take my... I wasn't prepared. You just go take the test. And so I looked out the window that morning, and the sun was shining, and so I put on my uniform of the day, which I'd consisted of. At this time, I weighed 160 pounds, or 165 pounds. I've never seen that weight ever again. I had a shirt that I had cut the sleeves off of that actually proudly across my chest proclaimed free me. Put on my pair of shorts and grabbed my number 2 pencil, put on my thongs, and I walked to class. And you get to class, and the test was in one of those big auditorium style where it's theater seating. So I look up to grab a seat, and I look out, and everybody in the class is... You're remarkably different. Every one of you is completely different from me. Every single one of you are in heavy winter clothing. I mean, not just like a windbreaker. I mean, I'm talking about the big over heavy coats, you know, the big scarves, hats pulled over where just the eyes show, gloves, because it's late November and it's northern Illinois. It's cold. But when I came to that morning, looked out the window, and the sun was shining, my neurons... See, by the time I got to you, I was in this shape. My neurons are firing, but they're really not hitting anything. I look out the window and go, ooh, sun. Warm. Free me. number two pencil. F. I didn't have a job that semester because I didn't want one, and I still had parents that would send me money, and they did, and so I didn't get a job, but that semester ended and my free life was over, and so I go home for the Christmas break, and by this time the relationship between my parents, my mother, my father is strained because I'm an alcoholic, and it's not just once or twice or a dozen times, it's just countless times where I've stolen their stuff. I've allowed their home to become a campground for thieves, and their home has been ransacked, and I've had numerous accidents with my father's automobiles, and I take his money and I take his stuff and I lie to him, and I strip him of his dignity. I take from him everything that he holds dear because I'm an alcoholic. Did I ever set out one day to do those things? No. But I'm an alcoholic, and I ended up doing those very things. You know, the book talks about that frothy emotional appeal for alcoholics seldom suffices. And I have a clear recognition one day of froth. My mother standing because I had to take her to work, and I remember her clearly just yelling at me, "Stop drinking. You're driving us insane." And those little puddles of white spittle were collecting at the corner. That's froth, man. So she was having some serious frothy emotional appeal that morning. It didn't suffice, I can tell you. So, I don't know, it was after Christmas, in between Christmas and the New Year holiday, my parents are going away to one of these company gigs that my dad is invited to, so he takes my mom, and now they leave their house one more time, and so I thought, you know what, I'm going to have one of those Hallmark moments, put a log on the fire, and, you know, just have a two or three good, close friends. You know. Maybe make some of that hot cocoa. It's one of those times where you invite three or four people, and about 85 show up, and I drink, and I don't run out that night, and I don't black out that night. I pass out, and I pass out in the corner of their my parents' home, and one more time, their home and their belongings and their stuff is laid waste by this gang of nefarious criminals, One of the examples, about 4 days later, my mother found up in their bedroom, in the upper story of the house is their bedroom, and in their closet they had their lockbox, all their personal papers, wills, deeds, all that stuff. 4 days later, my mother found that box beaten to within an inch of its life, jammed behind the furnace in the basement. And that's just an example. Of course, nothing was taken. That's the amazing thing about the only thing that didn't happen, is the would-be thieves couldn't get in. Now, the lockbox wasn't locked. But the brain power of obviously these criminals was a little suspect as well, and they couldn't figure out the little lunchbox latch that could, you know, so they just beat the box up. If I live to be 100, I hope I never forget the look on my father's face the next morning. There was nothing but really just hatred and despise. That's what I was looking at. The man hated me, and he had every right to hate me. I don't know if he hated, but I know he despised the thing that I had become. And in his mind, I'm a weak, pathetic, useless piece of crap. And he pretty much told me so. Very last thing my father said to me before I came to AA was, he looked me in the eye and he said, "You know, Dave, with a son like you, I don't need any enemies." And he was right. I had taken from him everything that was good and decent. Mostly what I took from him was his right to be happy. I am a thief of the utmost magnitude. I just don't care about you or what you're going through because I need to drink. So for whatever reason, on the second day of January 1981, you know, one of the things that my sponsor talks about today is a thing called grace. You know, and the definition that he uses of grace is it's an unmerited gift. I didn't earn it, don't deserve it. You know, I kind of chuckle to myself when I hear somebody say, "Man, I deserve AA. I don't deserve the right to be amongst good people like you. I should be in prison with people like me. I'm a thief. I'm a liar. I'm a person who commits acts of violence." I have no regard for the human beings I'm walking around with. And for whatever reason tonight, on this night, on the 23rd of November 2002, I'm standing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sober. And I know that within a very short distance of here, there's an alcoholic getting started again. Just about time, man. It's the witching hour. It's just about time to go get it. And that alcoholic might be coming up with a very good reason to drink. They had a bad day. But on the other side of that alcoholic is daughters and husbands and wives and children and grandchildren. And they're going to have one of those nights. And for whatever reason, now we stand here and we're sober. And our families are next to us. And we're enjoying the gift. And most of the time it ain't enough because I'm an alcoholic. I have to work at it being enough because I'm so selfish and self-centered. Book describes me. I have five traits. They're my constant companions. Book says that I'm, as an alcoholic, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. And then it says that I have self-seeking, self-pity, and self-delusion. My sponsor adds self-serving. I have a six-pack I walk around with every single day, and they're constant companions, and their only hope is to destroy me. And then I have to call a sponsor. Then I have to come to a home group meeting. Then I have to make a commitment. I go to a detox center. You know, I make commitments to this process. I stay away from the things that are going to allow me to be selfish and self-centered and self-serving. And it's almost impossible for an alcoholic. I need help. The most important word in our big book is the first word of the first step. It's why we survive, because we don't do it alone. I tried my whole life to not do it, and I failed every single time because I was doing it on my own. I don't have the power. I do not have the power. I've never had the power, and I'll never have it. And I failed every time I tried to not drink on my own. My only hope was, as I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on this fourth day of January 1981, and I didn't, you know, I prayed to a God, please help me, and he sent me to AA, and I swear on my mother's heart, you didn't look like the answer. And yet here you, and yet I know that you are. The power that runs through this room, it has the power to extract people from that stream of misery. That's the disease of alcoholism. And not only does it just extract the alcoholic, if the alcoholic doesn't want it, it can extract the family. And it can put the family on a path that says it's going to be okay whether the alcoholic drinks or doesn't drink. It's going to be okay. Stay here. But this is a very insidious disease, and it's patient, and it's cunning, and it's powerful, and it kills. So I get whooshed off to a treatment center, and I get whooshed off to a halfway house, and I get a year of sobriety, and I go to Norman, Oklahoma, and I fall into a group called the Big Book Group of Norman in Norman, Oklahoma. And it was a group that had sponsorship and had fellowship, and it had sponsors leading goofy newcomers through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of us didn't want it, but, man, the sponsors that could get somebody that wanted it, they gave of themselves 24/7. If they could help another alcoholic get sober, they did it. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, took me through that inventory the very first time. I was a little over a year sober. And I got to write out every dirty deed, all my resentments, all my fear, all my problems with sex, all those seven deadly sins that consumed me. And I wrote it all out as it describes in the fourth step of our inventory. And I put it on paper and I walked up his step, which seemed that day a mile long. And I told that man that entire inventory. I heard somebody describe the inventory as, you know, our whole life of alcoholic drinking and using is just a long exercise of discarding bad acts, bad actions, bad thoughts. And it's like you come home and you dump your crap in the backyard and you pull the drapes, don't look at it. And you do that every single day. And then you get sober. Sponsor comes over one day and pulls the blinds. And you look out in your backyard, man, it's full of crap. It's a big pile out there. And the inventory is going out into that backyard and taking that big pile of crap and making it a lot of little piles of crap. And you stick a flag in every little pile. Resentment, 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 fear, 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 sex, 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 fear, fear, resentment, 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 man, 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 man. Now you look out and it's a lot of little flags and little piles. Fifth step is getting somebody stupid enough to go out into the backyard with you while you tell them about every little pile. Now, my problem is that would be a nice ending. That would be a nice ending. My problem is I keep making piles. And the other part of this is that, okay, I've admitted all this stuff. What I have not looked at yet is I've got this huge number of people back here that I've just ruined, that I've had bad actions, and I've caused a great deal of pain. And our eighth and ninth step says, you know what, from this day, we're going to go forward, and we're going to try to repair that. We're going to try to change our actions. The word amend, you know what, I'm so grateful my sponsor said, you will never say you're sorry again. That's all I said. I'm sorry. It's like, pull the doll. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Sooner or later, they start agreeing with you. You're right, man. You're sorry. You're a sorry piece of crap. We know. So what my sponsor said is, you're never going to say that again. You're going to admit you did wrong and that you're there to change it, amend it, make it right. That's what amends are. We have to make it right. That takes action and that takes commitment and that takes a courage I do not have, because it's going to reduce my pride. And see, the only thing I had left to you when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was image. That's all I had left. I just had image. I could act cool and talk cool. When I first got to AA, my language was terrible. It's not much better. But I'll tell you, when I spoke, it was all little short phrases that had a lot of four-letter words in it and phrases that began with mother. And that's how I spoke to you, and I didn't care where I was. I could lie to anybody. I'm a Reformed ex-Catholic. I knew I was going to where you shouldn't be going. I used to go into those confessionals and lie to the priest just to see if I could get him to go, ooh. I dare you to walk out after doing something like that, go, man, I'm going, baby. I am pathetic. I am a loser. When I got to you, my scorecard read zero. And so the sponsor started taking me through the how do you change a life? See, the great thing that our forefathers in Alcoholics Anonymous did is they wrote it down. I don't have to come up with anything. I just follow the instructions in the big book. I don't have to come up with no new guides. I don't have to wait for the next smart person called psychiatrist to come. I don't need Dr. Phil to tell me what to do. I am an alcoholic. All I need is these steps and a sponsor who has the courage to tell me the truth. Now, what I do with that is my choice. And I'll tell you what happens. For most alcoholics, the truth is so unbearable, I'd rather not have it told to me. So I'm going to go someplace where they don't tell it to me. They say things like, oh, be good to you. Go have a nice day. Don't drink. Call me if you need me. I thank God I had a sponsor who pretty much, in fact, I'll tell you, my first sponsor, he came to me one time and he had a request, which was a direction, which I said no to. And he came from a different plane, I think. He said, well, do you want to step outside? Now, see, where I come from, you don't say no to that. So I said, you bet. Now, this guy stood about 6'4", and he had shoulders out to here, and he was a bad dude, man. And I walked out in the front yard, and for about the next 20 minutes, he beat the crap out of me. And when I was done, he had his foot on my chest. I said, I give up. And he said, that's step one. I didn't know that you could go to like sponsor police and say, man, that guy committed a crime. I didn't have anybody videotaping it. That man got drunk. About 4.5 years sober, he drank. He ain't back yet. His wife was sober, sponsored a lot of gals. She got drunk. Last I heard, she was in an insane asylum. The next guy I got as a sponsor died. And I got a guy by the name of Jim Shaw, and that man took me through steps, and he was a picture of action in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he started teaching me what it meant to be a sober member of AA. He was the most busy, he was the busiest member of our group. He was the most straight shooting. He told alcoholics the truth. He knew the book inside, outside, backwards, forwards. He knew that book better than anybody I'd ever met. We used to have a big book study meeting in that group where we'd actually count off, because we had so many of us that we'd have to go into four or five different rooms. And it didn't matter what my number was, whatever Jim was, that's where I went. I didn't care to listen to those other goofs. I sat next to Jim. He wasn't even my sponsor at this time. And I sat next to him because he had a message that had depth and weight to it. And he knew what alcoholics of my type needed. See, I don't know what anybody else is. That book describes alcoholics like me, and I am one. I need no other answer. In the 21-plus years I've been here, I've never had a life's problem that that big book or 12 and 12 didn't have the answer for. Not one time. But it's too easy. And I want to complicate it. So, real quick, we live in this town. We're active. We're doing a bunch of stuff. The clubhouse was on what we called AA Row, and it was the clubhouse was at the end of it, and then there was one normie we couldn't get out, and then there was like four houses of Alcoholics and Al-Anons all in there, and man, we just had block parties. We were all everybody was in each other's house. We fed each other. We laughed. We watched together. We walked to meetings. We walked back from meetings. We were always together doing something. And I was living in a house with about four or five other alcoholic guys. There was the house next was a bunch of alcoholic women, and then Susan was living with her two boys in this next house, and we started playing cards, and she went to an Al-Anon conference, and she came back, and one Sunday she invited me over for dinner, and we were in the kitchen, and she turned around, and I kissed her. And an amazing thing happened. I hadn't had that happen to me in a long time. So I did what I thought was the very next best thing I should do. I moved in. We were going along for a little while, and one night we're laying in bed, and she asked me a question. That's a bad question. And women, I suggest you never ask this question. Don't ever erase this question from your mind. She goes, "Baby, what are you thinking?" And before I could get the answer out or back, it was out. And I said, "You know what? I don't think I can marry you." Wrong answer. Thank you for playing our game. We have some nice departing gifts for you on the way out. Out the door I go. Now, at this point, like I said, Jim, when Vinoy had always been Susan's sponsor. At this time, Jim and Vinoy had moved to town, and they were, and so Susan just, you know, she moved into Vinoy's house, and I'm out the door, and I'm just crazy. The next day, wake up at the next Saturday night meeting, and at this time, our Saturday night meeting is a lot like our Saturday night meeting. After the meeting, the plan was always go over to Jim and Vinoy's house, and we'd just have fellowship. We were playing Trivial Pursuit was big. Just at that point, it was just coming out, and man, we'd just play Trivial Pursuit all the time, and we would just have a ball. Well, now Susan's there, and my mind's telling me I ain't wanted. That's a bad thought for an alcoholic. I'm 4 years sober. I'm sponsoring people. I'm taking meetings into prison. I'm doing it, man. And I'm leaving the meeting, and I know I'm not welcome somewhere. That's a bad thought for an alcoholic. So I thought, well, let me just investigate. So I drive by. And I drive by real slow, and I roll the window down. Did a drive-by listen. And I hear all the laughter, and I hear all the... Byron must have been there. And the very next thought was, screw it. And the right after that, the next thought was, let's go get drunk. I'm 4.5 years sober. And it's just that quick. I'm active. I'm active and I'm sober. And just like that, it's like this curtain came down. And there ain't no AA. There ain't no sponsor. There ain't no sponsorship. There ain't nothing. There's just anger. And it's undirected and it needs to be pointed at something. And the only thing I could point it at was, well, it's always been my answer to every problem in life. And so I go, well, let's go get drunk. I have never had a drink in Norman. And all of a sudden, I couldn't. Where do you go to get drunk? I had to stop. I had to put the car in park and think, do people get drunk in Norman? And at that, while I'm thinking about where I couldn't get drunk at, the thought came, go see if Chip's home. Got another member of our group at that point. And I know tonight that if Chip wasn't home that night, he'd have a different speaker. I drove over and Chip was home, and I walk in and I blow snot and cry and take all of your inventories, and it was just one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And I didn't drink that night. And the very next Saturday night meeting, Susan walked up to me. She had heard a joke, and she comes up to me and she goes, "What's the difference between a Yankee and a bucket of crap?" "The bucket." And if I could have shot laser beams, bing, bing, bing. But I couldn't, so I did the thing that came to my mind. I married her. And we got married on August the 3rd, 1985, and we just celebrated 17 years. And I don't know of anybody that's happier. You know, she's an active member of Al-Anon and sponsors a bunch of gals, and I'm an active member of AA, sponsor a bunch of guys, and our home is full. We've got two lines because our phones are always ringing, and all of you are always calling. And I wouldn't have it in any other way. Our favorite room we're redoing right now, but my favorite room in our home is our piano room, and it has all of your pictures in it. It has our memories of what life that God has given us. It's our 20 years plus in this program of just the joys of being sober and being a part of something. See, alcoholics have to run together. We're like a pack. You know, one of the things I used to always love to do is watch that Discovery Channel, because I love watching animals get chewed up on the African plain. Man, it's cool. And if you've ever seen the thing about the zebras, man, the zebras run out there, and they're all running in a pack because they have to. Because if they don't, man, the lions are sitting out there waiting for them. And the lions love eating zebras. And if you run in a pack, you're safer. And that's just like Alcoholics Anonymous, man. We got to run together. But what ends up happening is there's always one stupid zebra who thinks he can do it his way. Instead of running the pack's all over there eating that pile of grass. And the stupid zebra's over here going, "Hey, it ain't going to happen to me. I'm going to do it my way. I like that grass." And then you love. Then here comes the wolf, alcoholism. Just chews up the zebra. And maybe he makes it. He's just got big bite out of his butt. Maybe he doesn't have to die that time. But I bet you the next time when the pack goes this way, he's going to take him and half his butt, and he's going to go that way. But I'm an alcoholic. My mind tells me I should be running the pack. My mind tells me the pack ain't going in the right direction, and mostly my mind tells me I don't even need the pack. I can do it myself. I'm strong enough. And that's alcoholism. And we run in a pack, and every once in a while, one falls off, two fall off. Today, I'm surrounded by a lot of fat zebras, man. I'm in the middle, and I surround myself with a bunch of stupid other zebras, and let's go, man. We're going this way. Where are we going today, sponsor? I don't know. Let's go see the hyenas. I don't know. And Don and Shawnee. Real quick, you know, one of the hardest things I've had to do is I watch my mom start dying of the disease of alcoholism, and it was rough. One of the things, she started drinking, and she crossed that line, and she had phenomenon of craving, and it was the most painful thing I've ever gone through, is just watching her die of alcoholism. And I would call Jim, and Jim would just say, "Jim, I can't stand it." And he goes, "Well, I don't know." He would tell me the story about his father who got sober when he was 78, and he died with just shy of 10 years sober. So he'd just say, "You know, we don't know what God's got in store, so let's keep praying, and you just keep doing the right thing, and you go see her, and you tell her you love her, and you do the right thing." And then one morning, my dad, through a series of circumstances, my dad lost his job, and so he was at home. And one morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, he gets up, and my mom's not in the bed. And he's looking around the house, and he finds her in the kitchen chugging down a bottle of vodka. And about a day later, he calls me, and he said, "Man, what do we do?" And he called me back the next day, and he said, "We just stuck your mom in a treatment center." And that was on the 8th day of January in 1993. And on the 8th day of January in 1994, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sarasota, Florida, and I got to hand my mom her one-year sober medallion, like you might do tonight. And on the 8th day of January in 1998, I got to stand up in a meeting of Sarasota, Florida, and I got to hand her a five-year sober medallion. And in about 2 months, I'm going to stand up in a meeting in Sarasota, Florida. I'm going to hand my mom her 10-year sober medallion. My brother called me about 3 weeks ago, so drunk and so depressed and so insane that he was committing to blow his brains out. Alcohol runs rampant in my family. Now, tonight he's got a couple of weeks of sobriety. I don't know if it's going to last. People say to me, man, you should stop being so intense. You scare people. Well, sorry, that's probably not going to happen. I take sobriety very seriously. I take this program very seriously. And I really despise people who don't. Because alcoholism is an illness that kills people. Not only does it kill the people who have it, it kills a lot of people that have to stand by the people who have it. And it destroys us, and it destroys families, and it's serious business. Now, we have an awful lot of fun staying sober, but the fun comes after being part of. And one of the things our group stands for is let's tell the alcoholic the truth. We're going to tell you what you have and what you're going to need to do to recover from it. And there's going to be some requirements that are probably going to piss you off, and you have to tell you what, we really don't care. I've never been told one time in the 21 years plus I've been here by a sponsor to do something that treated me worse than alcoholism ever did. I've never been asked to rob a liquor store, beat up somebody. All I've been asked to do is come here, shave, stop dating her, okay, get in line, do what we do, and do it until you want to do it. Oh. That's too much, man. I think I'm going to go over here and eat this grass. Susan got real sneaky, and on my 15-year sober birthday, she flew in my parents, and they got to see Alcoholics Anonymous at its absolute finest. And everybody was dressed up like tonight, and man, it was a Alcoholics Anonymous shine that day. And that weekend was about sobriety, and my father got to hear Jim speak, and that was Jim's last AA talk, and it was just a great weekend. And when we took him back to the airport, my father pulled me aside. This is 15 years sober. My father pulled me aside, and he said, you know, Dave, he goes, you know, I thought you had a promising golf career, but after this weekend, I know that you've been called to a higher order. And what took 8 years of my life to destroy, it took Alcoholics Anonymous 15 to repair. And it's because of a sponsor who told me how to do it and what to say and when to say it and not ask for money and not do anything other than be your father's son and treat him with dignity that he deserves and start telling him that you love him. And the relationship between my father and I has been repaired. I stripped and took everything that man had, and I treated it like garbage. And because of the principles of AA, I've been given my relationship with my father back, and I don't deserve it, and I shouldn't have had it. But the power of this program runs deep, but it comes at a price. Every morning I wake up, I thank God for this program. I thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of AA and people like you that today I have a relationship with God, and for that I'll always be grateful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.